This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Hello, everybody. The door's still open, but it's 12:30, so I think we'll be prompt and get started. Welcome to the National Museum and to today's talk. My name's Kirsten Wainer. I'm the head curator of the museum's People and the Environment program, and it's my very great pleasure to be able to introduce Jennifer Wilson to you today. Jen, a little bit of background. Jen joined the museum as a curator in 2005. She reminded me that that was on International Museums Day, which she happily celebrates every year. And since that time, she's really contributed to a wide range of exhibition and gallery projects, things such as the Museum Circa Theatre, the Landmarks Gallery, and most recently, the display of the large objects in the museum's main hall, which you, I'm sure, are all familiar with or will have seen on your way in, including, of course, the fabulous Percival Gull, which I suspect may have been Jen's favourite object in that project. Over the many years, through a great variety of kinds of work, she's maintained a strong interest in Australia's aviation history. And over the past 6 months, she's been a curatorial fellow in the museum's research centre. And I think this has given her the opportunity to perhaps allow her interest in aviation history to blossom into something of an all-consuming passion, certainly if it goes by the conversations you have with her in the coffee queue. And today we're really reaping some of the benefits of her long interest in the museum, in aviation history and in the museum's collections relating to aviation. Jen's fellowship in the Research Centre focused on exploring how our National Historical Collection records and illuminates Australia's aviation history. It's actually often been said that the museum doesn't hold very strong or very interesting collections in this area. And I think Jen perhaps took a little bit of umbrage at this and set out to disprove this myth and set the record straight. She delved into the National Historical Collection, which holds some over 200,000 objects, and in it she discovered over 100 significant collections, which means several thousand objects which relate to our aviation history. And she'll tell you about some of those today, but certainly not all of them. I think it's really important to kind of know that over the last 6 months, Jen not only researched what the museum holds relating to aviation, but her work really did a fabulous job about making these collections much more accessible to both the museum staff and to the public, both now and in the future. Of course, as I said, the National Historical Collection is a large group of objects, and it's always a piece of curatorial work to really delve into and understand all the aspects of the objects and what they can actually tell us. Relating to aviation, Jen discovered quite a number of objects that we didn't really know that we held, identified many that we didn't know what they really were, and figured out that quite a few were something other than what we had written down. And fabulously, she documented the story surrounding these collections in a detailed, rigorous, and engaging way, as I'm sure you'll hear today. So this important research work, I think, not only helps us learn about Australia's aviation history, but as I said, it means that staff and our visitors well into the future can engage and draw on our collections. In many ways, it makes them useful. It brings them into their own as part of the nation's heritage. So much of the work that Jen completed during her fellowship, you'll hear a little bit about it today, but there's much more, and much of it will soon be accessible on the museum's website. And I'd certainly encourage you to check back over the coming months to our website if you'd like to learn more about particular collections or about the aviation holdings as a whole. So just before I introduce Jen and call her up, just a couple of very important housekeeping questions, not questions, statements. Of course, if you've got a mobile phone, if I could just please ask you to make sure that it's turned to silent. And also just to let you know that we are recording today's talk and the question session that will follow afterwards. Basically, if you choose to speak up and declare your presence here, we regard that as consent to you being recorded. So if you shouldn't be here, if you're meant to be somewhere else, just don't ask a question and we won't tell anybody. So it's my great pleasure to introduce Jen Wilson to you and to invite you to welcome her to give her talk, Joy Flights, Feats and Disasters, A Journey Through 1920s and 1930s Aviation in the Museum's Collection.
Hello. Can everyone hear me? Excellent. Thanks very much for the kind introduction, Kirsten, and thanks to everyone for coming today. As Kirsten sort of illuminated, I have ranged over more than a century in my research over the past 6 months, but for today I have limited myself to just 2 decades of history, otherwise we'd be here for quite a while. My aim today is to leave you more familiar with some of the personalities, events, aircraft and companies of the 1920s and 30s, as the National Museum's collections reveal surprising, tragic, funny and complex aviation stories from the period. While the National Museum is not recognised as a repository rich in significant aviation history, I have identified thousands of individual objects across more than 100 collections, and many of those items are important parts of aviation history rather than traditional aviation objects, but they speak to the growing nature and growing popularity of aviation through the 20th century. The stories in the National Historical Collection incorporate diverse subjects, including boomerangs and paintings, Australian flown, design or built aircraft, flying medical services, companies, and the feats of aerial daring which captured the public imagination. These stories are as much about passengers as about pilots and include famous, familiar, and forgotten individuals and events. I've had plenty of assistance throughout the last 6 months of research, and I would like to pay a special tribute to my colleagues in the registration team for supporting this project, including placing several of our items on display for you today. Thanks especially to the locations, documentation and photography teams. And thanks also to our librarians for their support in finding and purchasing some useful books and having some of those on display today as well. During the 1920s, many people believed that aviation would play an integral role in Australia's future, but aircraft crashes and fatalities and the expense of flying, among other reasons, meant that people were slow to realise the full potential. As we move through the 20s and 30s, we see many processes of trial and error as pioneer aviators sought to fly at faster speeds over longer distances and attract support for new adventures and commercial opportunities in the process. It was up to a new generation of young men and women to provide the energy and enthusiasm and inventive thinking to really get Australian aviation off the ground. And this is one of those fresh young faces. This is a photograph of Harry Hawker flying over Caulfield Racecourse in Melbourne in 1914, and his portrait is inset in the top left. In 1909, American John Armstrong claimed, "It is the car without wheels whereon the excited gaze of the civilised world is now fastened." And I like this photograph because it gives us a wonderful view of people looking up at the aircraft with a bit of wonder and amazement. The photograph was donated to the museum by the family of two spectators, which we can identify in the front. This is, if I can get this to work, this is Miss Hilda Maxwell and her young nephew, James Maxwell, who helpfully is actually not looking at the is looking at the camera, not the aircraft. Now, born in Melbourne in 1889, Harry Hawker became a qualified motor mechanic before he travelled to England in 1911 to pursue his dream of being an aviator. In 1912, he found employment with the Sopwith Aviation Company, where he started flying lessons and quickly gained his pilot's licence. He was a natural. Hawker became a test pilot for Sopwith and led the design team for the tabloid aircraft, which he's flying there, a short-winged biplane, at the time considered one of the fastest and most manoeuvrable aeroplanes in the world. He brought the aircraft to Australia for a series of exhibition flights in January through March 1914, accompanied by his friend and fellow Melbourne mechanic Harry Corper. Corper had found employment at the Sopwith Company only a few months before Hawker and had also had great success there. One of his inventions was the interrupter gear, which synchronised the firing of a machine gun through the rotating aircraft propeller. Hawker and Corper, two Harrys from Melbourne, made a significant contribution to the Sopwith Aviation Company during the First World War. Hawker was denied his opportunity to serve on the war front as his skills were considered in better service in the design and manufacture of war aircraft. After the war, he founded the Hawker Engineering Company, which became Hawker Aircraft Limited, one of Great Britain's most famous aviation companies, although Harry himself did not live to see the company's success. He died in a plane crash in 1921. Young Australian men like Hawker and Corper proved themselves during the First World War, whether on the front or in the factories, cementing partnerships and reputations that saw them found Australia's first airlines when they returned home. Hudson Fysh enlisted in the Australian Light Horse Brigade in 1914, transferring to the Australian Flying Corps in 1916, part of No. 1 Squadron, then also known as No. 67 Squadron of the Royal Flying Corps, which is why the collection features AFC and RFC badges from Hudson's uniform. During a number of missions, Fysh flew as a gunner and observer for fellow Australian pilot Paul McGuinness. After returning home, Fysh and McGuinness were commissioned to survey suitable landing sites in Queensland and the Northern Territory for the 1919 air race from England to Australia. During that very challenging journey in a modified Model T Ford, shown here on a commemorative postcard, the two aviators began developing plans for an aerial service across regional Australia. The Queensland and Northern Territory Aerial Service, today known as Qantas, was formally established in 1920, placing its headquarters first in Winton, Queensland, and then in Longreach, securing an airmail contract with the government in 1922. Hudson Fysh was managing director of Qantas from 1923, overseeing the company's headquarters move from Longreach to Brisbane and then to Sydney, the partnership with the British Imperial Airways, contributions during the Second World War, a federal government acquisition, and the introduction of jet aircraft in 59. Fysh was knighted for his services to civil aviation in 1953, retiring as manager of Qantas Empire Airways in 1955 and then as Qantas chairman in 1966. Brothers Keith Smith and Ross Smith were born in Adelaide, South Australia in 1890 and 92 respectively. Both entered aviation during the First World War, Ross with the Australian Flying Corps and Keith with the Royal Flying Corps in 1917. Keith did not see active service, being posted to several squadrons as an instructor. Ross served as a pilot with No. 1 Squadron of Australian Flying Corps with Fysh and McGuinness, carrying out reconnaissance works and attack on the Turkish ground forces, and he was highly decorated for his gallantry and devotion to duty. Following the end of the First World War, Prime Minister Billy Hughes declared his enthusiasm for the possibilities of aviation in Australia, and the Commonwealth Government announced a competition with a prize of £10,000 to the first successful flight to Australia from Great Britain in a machine manned by Australians. There were many critics of the competition in Australia and England, and there were not as many entries as Hughes had hoped. On the 12th of November 1919, Ross Smith as a pilot with Keith Smith as a co-pilot, bit of problems there, took off from Hounslow in a Vickers Vimy with mechanics Wally Shears and Jim Bennett. They arranged with the Shell Company to have fuel available en route, and they carried spare parts for repairs during their journey. They experienced hazardous flying conditions but completed the journey to Darwin on the 10th of December in 28 days and won the competition. Four of the six entries failed to complete the journey, and the Airco DH-9, flown by Ray Power and John McIntosh, departed London on the 8th of January 1920, arriving in Darwin 206 days later. The Smith brothers were both given knighthoods and travelled around Australia on aviation lecture tours, and their celebrity status is evidenced in the photo in the autographs captured here for a fan in 1920. Yes, thanks. Born in Hamilton, Victoria in 1889, Harold Treloar was employed as a driver for Young Brothers Auctioneers in Horsham from 1908 and then as a motor mechanic and driver in Hamilton and Ballarat. Treloar developed an interest in aviation and travelled to England, where he was accepted as a pupil at the British and Colonial Aeroplane Company in June 1914 for training in piloting and maintenance of aircraft. Treloar continued his training in Australia at Victoria's Point Cook Aviation School after enlisting with the Australian Imperial Force in 1914 and began service with the Australian Flying Corps in 1915. Treloar was one of the first members of the AFC to enter war service as part of the half flight sent to assist the Indian government against Turkish forces in April 1915. In August 1915, Treloar was reported missing and then confirmed a prisoner of war, Australia's first pilot POW, and he remained in captivity until the end of the war, November 1918. After returning to Australia, Treloar explored a number of commercial aviation interests, entering aerial races and offering joy flights during tours of Victoria and parts of New South Wales. His aircraft, an ex-military Airco DH-6, became known as the Flying Billboard, as it featured a number of advertisements for different companies on the fuselage and wings, such as Barnett Glass Tyres. And this helped finance his work. He was employed as an aviation officer for the British Imperial Oil Company in Adelaide, as a subsidiary of Shell Transport, from 1920 to 1940. One of Treloar's associates was Horatio Clive Miller, otherwise known as Horry. I like this photograph as it shows Horry here refueling the aircraft, and he's the only one in the photo doing any work. This is Treloar very helpfully leaning on some of his Shell products at the front of the photograph, doing nothing. This is where we start to see further connections between our 1920s aviators. Miller worked with Harry Hawker at the Sopwith Aviation Company before serving in the Australian Flying Corps, No. 2 Squadron, during the First World War. Back in Australia, Miller explored a number of commercial aviation activities before meeting Sir Macpherson Robertson, owner of McRobertson's Confectionery Company, and the two men established McRobertson Miller Aviation Company, for which Miller was managing director, chief pilot, and engineer. It was a very successful venture, continuing to operate passenger, freight, and medical aerial services until it was purchased by Ansett in 1963. One of the most memorable moments for the McRobertson Miller Aviation Company was its sponsorship of the 1934 Melbourne Centenary Air Race. The McRobertson Centenary Air Race, as it became known, from Middlehall near London to Melbourne, had a very attractive prize of £15,000 with 20 planes representing seven nations starting the race on the 20th of October 1934. Only 11 entrants finished the 18,000-kilometre trip, which stretched across 19 countries and seven seas. Pilots could choose their own route, but had to make five compulsory stops in Baghdad, Allahabad, Singapore, Darwin, and Charleville. It is not surprising, then, that a number of games manufacturers encouraged public interest in the event by creating games like this one for the public to follow the race events, which were reported daily in newspapers, and to have their own competitions. The race was won by British aviators Scott and Campbell Black in a de Havilland 88 Comet in a time of 2 days, 23 hours and 18 seconds. This was certainly the period for setting, breaking, and then setting new flight records, especially those for speed and endurance. It was an area in which Australian aviators seemed to excel. In February 1928, Herbert Lewis Hinkler, or Bert Hinkler, became the first person to fly solo from Britain to Australia, completing the journey in just 16 days. This bronze medallion was issued in 1928 in conjunction with Melbourne radio station 3LO to commemorate Hinkler's flight, amidst the great publicity surrounding his achievement. Of course, it's important to note that it was not only male aviators during this period who broke records and captured the public attention. The arrival of English aviator Amy Johnson in Australia in 1930 was one of the most widely reported events of the year. Johnson was the first woman to fly solo from England to Australia, piloting a Gypsy Moth biplane that she named Jason, from London to Darwin in just 19 days. Falling short of breaking Bert Hinkler's record by only 2 days, although the fact that a woman came so close to breaking Hinkler's record was widely reported by the media. The Australian public read daily newspaper reports of Johnson's flight, and it was felt at the time that she landed in Darwin that many people in Australia knew Johnny personally. After her flight, Johnson toured Australia, visiting Brisbane, Sydney, Canberra and Melbourne, and in each location was greeted by thousands of well-wishers. Johnson met Scottish aviator Jim Mollison while she was in Australia. He was working as a pilot for Australian National Airways at the time, and the two were married in England 2 years later. Johnson and Mollison set a number of flight records together and separately during their years of marriage, entering the 1934 McRobertson Centenary Air Race together, though they were not able to complete the journey. They divorced in 1938. This is my favourite photo of Jim Mollison, who was here. There he is, looking very tired and dishevelled. And there is actually footage of this same event on the National Film and Sound Archives website, which I encourage you to have a look at. Jim Mollison was indeed greeted by a large crowd and an enthusiastic kangaroo at Croydon Aerodrome in August 1931 after setting a new record of 8 days and 19 hours for a flight from Australia to England. Edgar Percival was born in Albury on the 23rd of February 1897. He was inventive and mechanically minded from a young age, working with his father on their property at Clarendon Park in Richmond, New South Wales. He was lucky enough there to be able to fly with Bill Hart, the first airman to qualify as a pilot in Australia. It was great inspiration for a young man. In 1915, Percival joined the Australian Infantry Force and achieved a commission with the Royal Air Force in 1917. Percival was a part of the Royal Air Force number 111 Squadron after its formation in Palestine in 1917. This necktie and badge show the insignia and motto of the squadron, cross swords, three saxes over a cross, and the word adstantes, which means standing by them. Percival served on numerous successful missions with number 111 Squadron before suffering hearing damage, and he was transferred to Squadron 123 as an instructor. After the war, Percival returned to Australia and undertook a variety of commercial flying activities, and this is a photo of Percival with some of his passengers on a beach, probably in New South Wales. And these are some of Percival's flying equipment. This is the flying helmet, which we've got on display in the showcase today, and a pair of gloves. They were essential for what were very cold and uncomfortable conditions in flying in an open cockpit. Percival made a number of flying tours through New South Wales and Victoria, and yes, as one paper reported, a number of ladies made trips with him. These flights were not cheap for passenger or pilot. In 1921, he was charging just over £2 for a five-minute flight, and in 1926, just over a pound, which was a lot in the day. Unfortunately, Percival encountered some difficulties with passengers and spectators not accustomed to aircraft, as on several occasions he had to swerve suddenly in his aircraft to avoid children and adults in his path during takeoffs and landings, on occasion damaging his aircraft and on one occasion resulting in a fatality. On a lighter note, this photo does highlight some of that wonderful aviation fashion. Percival believed that the existing aircraft he was using, many which were ex-military aircraft, were inadequate for Australian flying conditions, and they were. In 1929, Percival travelled to England hoping to sell his aircraft designs to an English manufacturer to get something better, but he was without success. Instead, Percival founded his own company, the Percival Aircraft Company, to design and manufacture Britain's first low-winged cantilevered monoplane, the Gull. The museum holds a Percival Gull 6 aircraft with registration GAERD, which you would have seen walking through the hall. Made by the Percival Aircraft Company in 1936, this aircraft was purchased by Ariane Defoe of Switzerland and registered HBOFU. After passing through several owners in Switzerland, the aircraft was sold to a collector and restored by Cliff Lovell in England, where it was featured on the airshow circuit for many years. Neil Jensen purchased the aircraft in 1983, and while it was based with him in Surrey, it was awarded the Percival Trophy of the Cotswold Aircraft Restoration Group. It's a really lovely example of an aircraft, and just as a special treat, a view of the inside. It's a three-seater. Percival won many competitions and awards flying his own aircraft, and the Gulls quickly established a reputation for high performance. It was a reputation reinforced through Percival's very active advertising campaign, of which these are just a few examples. This painting by renowned aviation artist Herman Bolin shows Edgar Percival flying his Mew Gull in the racing version of the Gull in the 1935 King's Cup Air Race, which is an annual British cross-country air race first contested in 1922. Percival was a competitor in the 1928, 1930, 1932, 33, 34, 35, 36, 37 and 38 King's Cup air races. But he never won the competition. His highest placing was third in 1937. In 1935, Percival placed fifth overall, competing in a Mew Gull of his own design and his company's manufacture, reaching over 200 miles an hour, about 320 kilometres per hour, for the first time in the race's history. There are many trophies awarded to Percival in our collection, but this is perhaps the most significant and is on display in the showcase here today. The Oswald Walt Gold Medal is regarded as the highest honour in Australian civil aviation, first awarded following the death of decorated First World War pilot Oswald Watt in 1921. The medal is presented to individuals for a most brilliant performance in the air or most notable contribution to aviation by an Australian or in Australia. Percival Gull received the award in 1936 for his flight to Africa and back in one day. From England, that is. In 1936, Percival moved his company to larger lodgings from Gravesend in Kent to Luton in Bedfordshire. And he continued to be an active personality in aviation. He's photographed here with one other aviation personality, American Douglas Corrigan. Corrigan was famous because in 1937 he took off in a single-engined aircraft from New York, intending to fly west to San Francisco, but made what he claimed was an intentional navigation error and flew east, arriving in England. Percival was there to greet Corrigan at Luton Airport and presented him with a Luton straw hat, the town being famous for its straw hat production for his achievements. And they shared a few laughs at the same time. Percival's Gull aircraft were flown by many famous aviators of the period, including Kingsford Smith and Gene Batten, with the speed and performance of the aircraft being responsible for setting many of the records of the 1930s. This is a painting of the Vega Gull flown by British-born Kenyan aviator Beryl Markham in September 1936, when she became the first woman to fly across the Atlantic east to west solo and the first person to fly from England to North America non-stop, travelling east to west. There's an amusing story shared by Percival and Markham, and I would like to read it today just as Percival wrote it for a speech in 1967. A month or two before Beryl's flight, a nightclub entertainer named Harry Richman planned to fly the Atlantic from America to England as a publicity stunt for his engagement at a London nightclub. He engaged well-known air pilot Dick Merrill to fly him in a Vultee aircraft. The flight was planned for some time before, and as the day of the flight approached, Harry became more and more frightened. He was being told by all and sundry how foolish he was. He was being given plenty of advice, and one of the pieces of advice he accepted was to fill the wings, fuselage, and all hollow parts of the plane with ping-pong balls so that the aircraft would float if forced down into the water. This he did, filling every available cavity he could find. The ping-pong balls attracted great publicity. The flight was successful, and they landed in Wales. A few weeks later, Beryl took off and crossed the Atlantic. When she returned to London, she asked me to accept a large photograph of herself on which she had inscribed, "To Percival, designer of a wonderful aircraft," from Beryl Markham, across the Atlantic in a Vega Gull and no balls at all. I must admit, when I first read that, I thought she meant something else, but... In May 1936, Amy Johnson, then known as Amy Mollison, made her last record-breaking flight, regaining her Britain to South Africa flight record in a Percival Gull 6. This logbook in the museum's collection records Johnson's record flight all the way from her test flights with Percival at Luton Airport to her arrival in South Africa. Back in Australia, one of the main activities behind the progress of aviation was the carriage of airmail, and moves in that area were made quickly. In 1914, visiting French aviator Maurice Guillaume carried the first official airmail from Melbourne to Sydney, then the longest airmail delivery in the world. When Harry Butler returned from service with the Australian Flying Corps in 1919, he flew an airmail delivery from Adelaide to Minalton, South Australia, stating, "The plane was great in war, but it will be even greater in peace." Between May and October 1920, Harold Treloar was employed with the Sunraysia Daily newspaper to deliver it to locations throughout South Australia. And in December of that same year, Sydney retailer David Jones commissioned the first delivery of Christmas parcels by aircraft, as commemorated in this postcard. As airmail services expanded across Australia and internationally, it created its own type of collectible product, aerophilately. This example from the collection is a flight cover flown in Faith in Australia by Charles Arm as part of the first official airmail delivery to New Zealand from Australia in February 1934. Another key contributor to aviation's development during this period was the provision of aerial medical services across regional and remote Australia. This mixed media artwork was made by the Darling River Group of the Country Women's Association of New South Wales. The central artwork features are Nancy Bird Walton and her Gypsy Moth aircraft. Nancy Bird Walton made a significant contribution to Australian aviation, especially for female aviators, founding the Australian Women Pilots Association. In 1935, Bird was hired to operate an air ambulance service in outback New South Wales, including the district of the Darling River Group, including Broken Hill, Ivanhoe, Whitecliffs and Wilcannia. It was named the Far West Children's Health Scheme, and Bird used her own Gypsy Moth aircraft for the service. This transceiver came to the museum from the Australian Broadcasting Commission, or ABC, with no story as to its exact use, but it's a very important example of equipment developed to support the Royal Flying Doctor service. In 1928, Reverend John Flynn began experiments for the provision of an aerial medical service to rural and remote areas of Queensland from a base in Cloncurry using Qantas aircraft. In 1934, several state and territory-based operations were amalgamated into a national network called the Australian Aerial Medical Services, which was renamed Flying Doctor Service in 1942 and got its royal charter to become the RFDS in 1955. Young engineer Alfred Traeger began working with Flynn in 1926 in the Northern Territory to develop radio transceivers for the then-proposed Aerial Medical Service, that would provide support for flying doctors and provide assistance to isolated Australians. The resulting Pedal Wireless was introduced to Queensland in 1929, and Traeger's time was divided between his workshop and the field where he taught radio operating and Morse code. This transceiver dates from the period about 1935 to 1942. It has a switch, or switches here, to move between Morse code and telephony. This unit became standard for many years. Not only were transceivers indispensable equipment for communicating during medical emergencies, but they also became a key instrument in social communication. The introduction of telephony with this model of transceiver opened regional and remote Australia to what became known as Galah sessions, which were allocated periods of time during the day when the radio service was used for chatting, sharing news or recipes, and arranging gatherings. Not surprisingly, the collectors of the world managed to find a side interest in the important work of these transceivers. QSL cards were used to confirm that a listener had heard a particular radio station, with QSL referring to the Morse code shortcut, a Q code, in the form of a question, "Do you acknowledge receipt of?" After a period of time, stations realised that they were issuing QSL cards to people who were not actually hearing the station at all, but simply collecting QSL cards. No doubt, like this particular collector who's represented, and you can see his address is in Auckland in New Zealand, but he's still a fan of the Cloncurry Medical Service. As the possibilities of Australian aviation cemented themselves, commercial airlines increasingly looked to expand their services overseas. This park painting by an unknowing artist provides a link to one of those expanding networks. In 1934, Qantas Empire Airways was formed, combining the interests of British Imperial Airways and Qantas for a new England-Australia service. Qantas started the service between Darwin and Singapore with DH-86 aircraft, but soon introduced flying boats to the service, ushering in a new era of travel. This painting, titled Spirit Islands, was originally owned by Fred Gray, the founder of the Umbakara Aboriginal settlement on Groote Island. Groote Island is the largest island in the Gulf of Carpentaria, a Dutch name meaning Big Island. The Aboriginal settlement was established on the shores of Little Lagoon, Port Langdon, on the northeastern coast of Groote Island in 1938. The location of the settlement was determined by the establishment of the flying boat base on the northern shores of the lagoon. The base was initially created for the Qantas Empire Airways as a refuelling facility and leased to the Shell Company. The Royal Australian Air Force assumed control of the base from 1942, using it until the end of the war when it was completely abandoned. Although Qantas became Australia's overseas airline, perhaps the most significant attempt to excite people to the possibilities of aviation was the Trans-Pacific flight of the Southern Cross and crew in 1928. Charles Kingsford Smith and Charles Ulm, with the American crew members Harry Lyon and James Warner, became the first people to cross the Pacific Ocean by air, leaving Oakland, California on the 31st of May 1928, and via Hawaii and Fiji, landing in Brisbane on the 9th of June, having completed the 11,585-kilometre crossing in 83 hours, 38 minutes of flying time. When Kingsford Smith and Ulm travelled to America to pursue their dream of completing the Trans-Pacific flight, they were contacted by Antarctic adventurer and explorer Herbert Wilkins. Wilkins believed that he was the owner of the only aircraft at the time that could complete the journey successfully, a tri-motor Fokker aircraft that he had used in some of his Antarctic expeditions. Kingsford Smith and Ulm managed to get the funds together to secure the aircraft, and alterations were made at the Boeing factory in Seattle for the flight. And just a bit of a look inside the Southern Cross. Some of the photographs in our collection really bring alive the actual conditions. This is the cockpit featuring the very large fuel tank, which was put behind the pilot and co-pilot's seat, not allowing much space for the pilot and co-pilot. And this is the other side of the fuel tank. This is the navigator's station and the radio operator's station. And there's a great photo of radio operator James Warner at his post. And you can see the writing on the Southern Cross fuselage indicating that there's not much between Warner and the outside world. Very comfortable flying conditions for an 83-hour journey. Although Qantas became... James Warner enlisted in United States of America in the Navy in 1911. He served in the Western Pacific and China, and in 1916, Warner began training a new generation of electricians and radio operators. He became first chief radio man in the US Navy. After the war, while working as a salesman in San Francisco, Warner heard that that navigator Harry Lyon, who he had served with during the war, was joining the Trans-Pacific flight planned by Kingsford Smith and Ulm. At that stage, Warner had not yet flown an aeroplane, but he joined the Southern Cross crew and began preparing radio equipment for the flight. Warner's radio equipment and skills played a key role in the navigation effort for the flight. As summarised, a radio beam would be sent from Wheeler Field in Hawaii to the US Army's Crissy Field in San Francisco. If all went well, this meant that the Southern Cross was on course and Warner would hear a constant reassuring buzz in his headphones. Warner's achievements were widely touted as the first successful continuous radio communication on a long-distance flight, and Warner received many accolades from the Australian radio community, including the certificate from the Wireless Institute. Prior to their departure, the Americans, Warner and Lyon, were required to sign a contract prepared by Charles Arm. The contracts were created to ensure that the accolades for the successful Trans-Pacific flight would go to the Australians, emphasising that Warner and Lyon were hired for the job, but the real work had been done by Kingsford Smith and Ulm. The basis for this arrangement was no doubt related to Kingsford Smith and Ulm's increasing debts and financial strain, which they hoped would be solved by receiving a government grant at the end of their journey. The contract, a copy of which is in our collection, stated that Warner and Lyon would leave the flight in Fiji, with the journey from Fiji to Australia less demanding on navigation, though this clause was later ignored. The crew members emphasised that their friendship and mutual respect had developed throughout the flight, and Warner and Lyon were treated like heroes in Australia as well. Returning to California, Warner and Lyon were each presented with a gold commemorative medal and $10,000 by the citizens of Oakland, and the medal is engraved Oakland, California to Sydney, Australia, May 1931, 1928, with portraits of Warner and Lyon. So they did get quite a lot of attention back in their homeland. This photograph shows Kingsford Smith and Ulm at the centre, with a crowd of well-wishers on their arrival in Honolulu. I like this photo because the crew were mostly deaf at this stage of the journey due to the noise of storm and, of course, the very noisy engines of the aircraft. But they were still faced with many questions and cameras from every angle, so it was an interesting landing. Not surprisingly, Kingsford Smith and Ulm were very glad to reach Australia, and this is a gift presented to Smithy from Ulm, a cigarette case engraved with the simple message, "We made it," and it's on display for us here today as well. The airmen were instant celebrities. These are just two. This is just one of the many luncheons presented in their honour. A luncheon at Parliament House in Canberra. Kingsford Smith and Ulm there were presented with honorary appointments in the Royal Australian Air Force. And not forgetting the numerous poems and songs produced in their honour with some very patriotic sentiments for the time. Riding on this wave of popularity, Kingsford Smith and Ulm decided to establish an airline company. Australian National Airways Limited was registered in Sydney in December 1928, with Kingsford Smith and Ulm as joint managing directors. The initial vision for the company was to offer pilot training and operate passenger, mail and freight services between cities and towns in eastern Australia. Based on the success of their exploits in the Southern Cross, Kingsford Smith and Ulm ordered five trimotor Avro 10 aircraft from AV Roe & Co. in England. The Avro 10 were similar in appearance to the famous Southern Cross. They were actually a version of the Fokker aircraft manufactured by Avro under licence from Fokker. The new aircraft were named Southern Cloud, Southern Star, Southern Sky, Southern Moon and Southern Sun. In 1928, Australian National Airways called for tenders to construct a large hangar and maintenance workshops at the Mascot Aerodrome in Sydney, suitable for their new fleet of aircrafts and their intended operations. Kingsford Smith and Ulm decided to travel to England to inspect the aircraft under construction while also surveying aerial flying routes and to engage pilots, engineers and support for their adventure. They were forced to make an emergency landing north of Derby in Western Australia, and an aerial search party was sent to try and find the Southern Cross and crew. The Kookaburra, one of the aircraft involved in the search, crashed, killing aviators Keith Anderson and Bob Hitchcock. Although Kingsford Smith and Ulm were rescued and eventually continued on to England, the forced landing and the subsequent inquiry damaged their reputations. The museum holds this photographic and written account of the 1929 expedition to recover the bodies of aviators Anderson and Hitchcock from the wreckage of the Kookaburra. It was compiled by the driver of the expedition, Raymond Miles, with the assistance of his daughter. The expedition was undertaken in a British A3 Thornycroft truck, supplied free by the importer of the vehicle, and the crew was made up of four men, Frank Nottle, Les Miles, the driver mechanic, William Berg, a journalist, and Constable George Murray. On the 24th of May, the Thornycroft and crew members were transported by train from Adelaide to the railhead near Alice Springs. The expedition was directed to travel to Newcastle waters and find the hoof marks of horses left in the ground by the party that had secured the crash site about 1 month before. That was the way that they needed to guide themselves to the crash site, and so the Thornycroft expedition was accompanied by four Aboriginal guides. The truck suffered numerous tyre punctures and travelled slowly through the loose sand, but on the 11th of June found the horse tracks and 8 days later located the Kookaburra wreck. The Thornycroft expedition could not recover the aircraft but cleared a runway in case it could be flown out at a later date. They recovered the bodies of Anderson and Hitchcock and transported them back to Alice Springs and then to Adelaide for burial. Despite these early problems for the airline, Australian National Airways began regular services in 1930 between Sydney and Brisbane. This paperweight of an Avro 10 aircraft was used by Ulm on his desk during that time. Kingsford Smith and Ulm worked vigorously to repair their popularity, and Kingsford Smith set off to make a successful east-west crossing of the Atlantic in the Southern Cross and then set a new England to Australia record in the Southern Cross Junior. Ulm capitalised by promoting ANA flights as an opportunity to fly with the famous aviators. The ANA service was promoted as fast, efficient, safe, and by March 1930 had carried over 1,000 passengers and 1,200 kilograms of freight. Services were extended to Melbourne and Launceston, with Australian National Airways becoming the first interstate airline. The engineering and maintenance staff at Mascot Hangar were also increased, with a staff of 42 working in shifts. These photographs feature a group of theatre performers travelling between Melbourne and Sydney on the ANA aircraft Southern Sky. The passengers included dancer Iris Brown, wife of Herbert Brown, the tenor, en route to board a ship to New Zealand where they were to perform in several musicals. Iris is seated here, beside this wonderful cane chair inside the Southern Sky. It looks pretty basic, but these cane chairs were actually the latest in passenger comfort, and they had seat pockets which contained reading material, the latest newspapers of the day, and mints to ward off travel sickness. So it was very fancy. On the 21st of March 1931, ANA's aircraft, the Southern Cloud, failed to reach Melbourne on a scheduled service from Sydney. It was believed that the Southern Cloud, carrying six passengers and piloted by Shortridge and apprentice Charles Dunnell, had crashed in severe weather conditions. Despite the suspension of ANA services and all pilots and aircraft being deployed in extensive search efforts, the tragic disappearance of the Southern Cloud remained a mystery. The Air Accidents Investigation Committee could not assign a cause for the loss, but made a series of recommendations that led to new airline operating standards, including the adoption of radio communications, which made aircraft travel safer for generations to come. The wreck of the Southern Cloud was not discovered until 1958, when Tom Sonter, a carpenter working on the Snowy Mountains scheme, happened upon the crash while bushwalking near Kyandra in New South Wales. Within days of the discovery of the site, hundreds of people visited, collecting many souvenirs. Among the visitors was Canberra political journalist Alan Reid and his son, Alan Jr. Reid wrote a number of articles about the Snowy Mountains, in addition to his regular work covering federal politics. Alan Jr. brought the clock back to Canberra, where he showed it to fellow classmates at Canberra Grammar School. One fellow student, John Boddington, then in Grade 8, sensed the historical importance of the relic and bought it from Reid for 5 shillings. Another visitor to the site was Sydney Morning Herald journalist Frank Proust. The searchers found the aircraft's three engines buried in the ground. The Sydney Morning Herald reported that the Southern Cloud was hidden in the long grass where many instruments had been ripped out of the instrument panel by the force of the crash. Many were burnt beyond recognition, but the tachometer plate, which is here, from the instrument panel was found in good condition. Proust took the dial as a souvenir of the crash, and it's actually on display in the Eternity Gallery downstairs. Charles Donnell, who was the co-pilot who died in the Southern Cloud disaster, began his pilot engineer apprenticeship with Australian National Airways in 1929 and was part of the company from its beginnings. Donnell moved into the accommodation at Coogee to be closer to his new workplace in Mascot, despite the misgivings from his family about the dangers of his chosen profession. His family donated Donnell's licence, shown here, and several photographs to the museum, and it's wonderful to have an employee of National Airways represented in the collection. Throughout every tragedy and triumph for Australian National Airways, there was company secretary Ellen Rogers, whom Kingsford Smith and Ong called Rog. This is a photo montage of ANA and its operations made by Charles Arm and his wife Mary as a gift for Ellen Rogers. This is a photograph of Ellen at the centre of the montage, and it also includes an original painted star from the original fabric of the Southern Cross. It was recovered a couple of times. Born in Maitland, New South Wales in 1906, Ellen Rogers was just 21 years old and working for the Atlantic Union Oil Company in Sydney when the Southern Cross and crew completed their flight across the Pacific in 1928. The Southern Cross had used Atlantic oil and fuel when making its historic flight, so the company assisted the aviators on their return to Australia. As the managing director of Atlantic was away at the time, Rogers was assigned to work with Kingston Smith and Ulm throughout their hectic round of public receptions and interviews, and she carried out secretarial duties for the aviators. Rogers was given many gifts by her appreciative employers, who I think she kept pretty organised at the time. This half bearing from the centre engine of the Southern Cross was in place for the Trans-Pacific, Trans-Tasman and Australia to England flights made in 1928 to 1929. The steel bearing was probably removed during the complete overhaul the aircraft received at the Fokker Company in Amsterdam when Kingsford Smith visited there in 1929. The propeller hub, which is also on display here today, was removed from one of ANA's Avro 10 aircraft. The collection also includes material from another ANA employee. William Bosang was born in Ireland in 1900. He travelled to Australia in 1924 and began working with Kingsford Smith as an engineer for Australian National Airways. Like many of those who work with Kingsford Smith, Bosang had a sense of commemoration and memorialisation of his time with Australian National Airways, keeping photographs, newspaper clippings and writing poetry about the Southern Cross and her crews. I won't read any of that today, but it's actually not very good. So, but the sentiment was there. A sharp decrease in passenger numbers and financial difficulties attributed by the Great Depression forced ANA's directors to suspend all services in June 1931, and after several failed attempts to salvage the company, in 1933 ANA entered voluntary liquidation. This attaché case was used by Charles Arm from 1928 until 1934, including his preparations for the Southern Cross Trans-Pacific flight. Following the demise of ANA, Ulm continued to promote the benefits and efficiency of air services, establishing a new company, Great Pacific Airways Limited, to operate a San Francisco to Sydney service. The shipping label on the back of the case is inscribed Olympic, 5th of October 1934, recording the details of Ulm's journey from the United States of America to England to collect the Airspeed Envoy aircraft Stella Australis, in which he disappeared flying from California to Hawaii in December 1934 to start his new venture. Kingsford Smith also continued to promote the future possibilities of air services after ANA by attempting further flight distance and speed records. This simple piece of paper tells an interesting story about a flight made by Kingsford Smith and Patrick Gordon, or Bill Taylor, in the Lady Southern Cross in 1934. Kingsford Smith and Taylor had a long association in Australian aviation. Both had served in the Royal Flying Corps, and Taylor flew as a pilot with Australian National Airways. Kingsford Smith and Taylor planned to fly together in the 1934 McRobertson Centenary Air Race, but modifications to their aircraft, named the Lady Southern Cross, were not completed in time. Disappointed to miss the lucrative air race, which they were hoping to win, in an effort to reimburse their race sponsors, later that year Kingsford Smith and Taylor decided to fly the Lady Southern Cross from Australia to California, where they would sell the aircraft. Their flight was completed in 51 hours and was the first successful west-east crossing of the Trans-Pacific. Completed and signed by Kingsford Smith, this simple flight manifest, or customs form, is a record of the first foreign registered aircraft and crew to land in Honolulu, as when the Southern Cross had made the journey in 1928, it travelled under American registration. As no paperwork existed at the time for receiving an aircraft, this is actually a shipping manifest that was adapted. Vessel has been crossed out on the form, and aircraft handwritten by Kingsford Smith to make the form more accurate. From 1935, Taylor operated a succession of Percival Gull 4 and Gull 6 aircraft on private and charter flying, and he became the agent for Percival aircraft in Australia. He went on to make many important contributions to Australian aviation. In 1935, Taylor and Kingsford Smith flew together again, this time in the Southern Cross, for what was a rather dramatic adventure. On the 15th of May 1935, carrying a cargo of Jubilee airmail, Kingsford Smith, Taylor and radio operator John Stanage were forced to turn back to Sydney en route to New Zealand when an exhaust manifold on the centre engine broke off and damaged the starboard propeller. And this is a photograph which shows the damage to the propeller. And there were numerous other problems. In an effort to make it back to Sydney safely, the crew jettisoned some of the cargo, which is bad when it's official Royal Mail, and Taylor climbed outside the aircraft to collect oil from the disabled starboard engine, which he then transferred to the port engine. Taylor was awarded an Empire Gallantry Medal for his bravery. And he was possibly a little bit crazy, but if he wanted to survive, that's what they had to do. We're lucky enough in our collection to have a fragment of the propeller, the damaged propeller. We understand that a young Victor Piper was part of the crowd that greeted the aircraft and crew after their hazardous flight and was given this piece of broken propeller by Kingsford Smith. And the propeller fragment is actually on display just outside this theatre in the Journeys Gallery. As an added piece of history, this is a very well-travelled piece of wood. The propeller fragment was actually taken by Australian-born astronaut Andy Thomas on board his Shuttle Discovery mission in March 2001. This is former director Dawn Casey handing the fragment over to Thomas for his trip. Thankfully, he brought it back safely. Following the unsuccessful Trans-Tasman flight, plans were made to retire the ageing Southern Cross. It was repaired and then purchased by the Commonwealth Government in order to preserve it for the nation, and it's now at the Brisbane Airport. As a coincidence, today marks 78 years to the date that Kingsford Smith handed the Southern Cross over to the government. It is not surprising that in these decades, someone would be inspired to create a memorial to the achievements of Kingsford Smith, ALM, and their aircraft, the Southern Cross. Austin Byrne was born in 1902 in Newcastle, New South Wales. After his father died, Byrne and his younger brother were sent to St Michael's Orphanage, and Byrne later returned to the family home, but left school at the age of 12, suffering severe depression. In 1914, Byrne saw French pilot Maurice Guillaume fly his Blériot monoplane to deliver Australia's first airmail from Melbourne to Sydney. And in 1928, Byrne was at Mascot Aerodrome in Sydney as part of the crowd of thousands that greeted the Southern Cross after the Trans-Pacific flight. In 1930, Byrne began constructing this model of the Southern Cross, dedicating around 5,000 hours of his spare time across 3 years to the project. He intended the model to be a gift to Kingsford Smith on his return after another record-breaking flight from England to Australia. But when Kingsford Smith tragically disappeared, Byrne decided to mount the model on a marble pedestal as part of a tribute to the aircraft and its original crew. Not stopping there, Byrne decided to create further metal and marble artworks and established the Southern Cross Memorial, which he toured to New Zealand, America and Holland, all 2 tonnes of it. And I'd like to show you some components of the memorial. They are quite stunning and amazing, and thanks to our photography team for making them look even better. This is a globe of the world that Byrne made out of aluminium and mounted on this wonderful pedestal. It features in these studded jewels the paths that the Southern Cross flew, and they're all colour-coded on this wonderful key. So the journeys trans-Pacific to England, across Australia and over to New Zealand, and every city and town that the Southern Cross visited is also represented by a jewel. It is large and very beautiful and shiny. Next, Byrne created what he called the shrine, which I guess explains itself in a way. this amazing piece of metal on a solid, well, in a solid piece of marble, features photographs of many of the contributors to the flights of the Southern Cross. And inside these doors, Byrne also hand-wrote an entire history of the Southern Cross with contributions from the aviators of the period. And he made the book himself. Oddly enough, with all of these other pieces, he thought that the book was the hardest thing he ever had to make, possibly because he actually shot the kangaroo that he then made the book with. It's bound in kangaroo hide. It's quite extraordinary, but he made every single component of each artwork. And this is the last piece of the main memorial that he made, the Book of Remembrance, and it's on its receptacle, its platform, with 3 globes which represent the Pacific, the Tasman, and the transatlantic voyages of the Southern Cross, with portraits of Kingsford Smith and Ulm in place. They are amazing pieces. Byrne, in this, what he called the Book of Remembrance, encrusted with these opals, black opals, representing the Southern Cross. In that, he placed letters. He wrote to basically every famous aviator from the period who'd worked with Smithy and Ulm, and got them to write back with tributes, and he placed those in this amazing box for people to read. I'll conclude with a quote from Amy Johnson. I think it is a pity to lose the romantic side of flying and simply to accept it as a common means of transport, although in the end that is what we have all ostensibly been striving to attain. The National Museum's collection paint a very busy picture of aviation during the 1920s and 30s, helping to preserve and remember the realities and the romanticism that this period inspired. Everything you've seen on screen today is from the National Museum's collection, and the successes and failures of these aviators form the foundation for Australia's aviation industry. I've enjoyed exploring these stories, and I hope you have today as well. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jen. We're a little bit over time, but we probably have time for 1 or 2 very short questions. We do have a microphone roving around, and I will just ask you, if you'd like to ask a question, to just put your hand up and call for the microphone so that we can record it. So, any questions?
Yes. Hi. Sorry, microphone.
Sorry,
just here.
Is it true on the America to Australia flight that they could only communicate from the pilot by a fishing line with a note on the end?
That's right, yeah. Not very efficient, but the actual pieces of paper that they pass, the messages, are actually in the National Library's collection. And it's just, I mean, it was just the noise of the engine plus that massive fuel tank that was sitting between the navigators and the pilots. Yeah, that was the only way that they could communicate. So,
Are there any plans for a special exhibition of the museum's artefacts?
Not in the immediate future. There are proposals in place, but we're trying to get more and more up online, up on our website, which is through the efforts of these pieces of photography, and then further biographies that are online. So it's sort of an online exhibition at the moment, but we do hope that some of it will be out physically in the future. Parts of it have been out in the past, and as I indicated, some of it is on display in our galleries at the moment. So fingers crossed, but we'll get as much out as we can.
Do you have any connection with the Aviation Historical Group in Melbourne?
I am a member.
You are a member.
Yes.
That's good.
Yes. They're a wonderful group and, have done a lot.
Yeah. Just interested to know if the collection has anything more on the Australian women pilots of the 1930s besides Nancy Bird.
Unfortunately, we are a little bit limited in that area. It's wonderful to have some material from, I guess, female contributors and passengers, but yes, it's a little bit light in that area at the moment. We do have some material for later female contributions, flight attendants, and that sort of thing from the 1940s onwards.
Okay, so none of the pioneering record breakers?
Unfortunately, no.
Thank you.
Yep. A lot of that material is in the Powerhouse Museum's collection and also the National Library and Melbourne Museum.
What was that, Heidi?
I have a goofy anecdote.
Oh, go for it, yes.
Well, let's finish with Heidi's goofy anecdote.
Oh, everyone loves a goofy anecdote. I spent a lot of time growing up in Tumbarumba, and recently there's been a beautiful, incredibly stunning memorial put up to the Southern Cloud, which was rediscovered in 1958. But the truth is, all the locals knew where it was.
Yes.
They just didn't know anyone was looking for it.
It's an interesting moment, really. There were a lot of rumours over the years, that's one of them.
All right, well, I think we might draw a close for a little bit over time. I wanted to just say thank you very much, everybody, for coming today. Please do take the time to stop and have a look at the objects that are on display. And finally, just I would ask you to join me once again to thank Jen for the fabulous talk.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.